I don't see the little running person.
I don't see the little blue man.
There he is.
Okay, now we can.
All right. Good morning. I'd like to call to order the meeting of this Joint Interim Task Force on Primary and Mental Health Care Reimbursement. So all of you know you're in the right room at the right meeting. In case you thought this was on tax reform or something more entertaining, that's not it. So good morning. I'm Mary Grant. I'm one of the co-chairs. Dr. Kincaid is the other co-chair, and we welcome all the visitors and everyone else who's made the time on this Friday morning to be with us. So the first part of this meeting is going to be an informational meeting, and I think I'll let Dr. Kincaid sort of talk about the folks that he's brought from the physician perspective.
The attempt of our time this morning is to really begin to understand some of the perspectives of providers within our state, the challenges they have with respect to workforce, challenges with respect to delivery of a care model, and how payment models, reimbursement actually affect their ability to succeed. And so we're hopeful today to have both perspective from some of the challenges represented within the physician organizations, but also the challenges are represented within our nurse practitioners as well, and we hope to have over the course of time a perspective from all of the providers that potentially could be affected by reimbursement changes. Now, we won't have representation necessarily, but we'd like to have perspective, and so our hope is to try to understand the optimal care model and then again build a payment model that supports that. So today's attempt is to really be able to understand some of the critical pressures. Last meeting, Dr. Smith was kind enough to bring some perspective with the challenges we have in primary care, significant workforce challenges, both on the nurse practitioner and physician provider side. And so at this point, we wanted to understand the behavioral health community and some of the challenges they have with respect to workforce. And so that's the intention of the time this morning. So we're hopeful that the information will help inform our further discussions. We're going to start with our physician organization, the Oregon Psychiatric Physicians Association, and we have three representatives today that have been kind enough to take time on the Friday before spring break at 8 o'clock in the morning without caffeine to come and speak to some of the challenges that their constituents have experienced in both in delivery of general psychiatry care, but also some of the real challenges with specialty psychiatry services, and then some of our geographical challenges. So we're hopeful of doing that. So this morning we have Dr. Dick, who is actually the legislative chair for the association, as well as Dr. Flagel, who is the president-elect, and we have David Carnorville, who is the president of the association. So we're very fortunate to have the executive leadership with us this morning to explain some of the dynamics in delivery of psychiatric care. So I'm going to turn it over to this esteemed group.
Not on.
What's the on button? There is, I don't think there is one.
Is it an IQ test?
Hello?
Do you know how to turn the mic on?
No, it's on.
It is? Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no...
That's okay.
Okay. All right. Well, so much for that IQ test.
And the microphones, again, are more for recording purposes.
Great. My name's Kathy Flagel, and I am the president-elect for Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. And my background is that I was a primary care internist for 16 years in Portland. So I was on the front end of many of the things that you discussed last month about what do primary care doctors do when they have mental health issues. I went back to train in adult and child psychiatry in the late 90s, not my late 90s, but the late 90s. And I've been practicing adult, child, and adolescent psychiatry since 2002. My experience is 10 years of inpatient psychiatry at Portland Providence Medical Center, so I have taken care of patients from all over the state, whether they are referred by parents, schools, primary care doctors, nurse practitioners, licensed clinical social workers, psychologists. So I've worked at the most acute level. I am currently an assistant professor at OHSU for the child psychiatry residency and fellowship program. So I'm very interested in creating changes in the training programs to meet workforce needs, because I think the past has been training psychiatrists to be able to do all things in their office as well as consultation. So my PowerPoint didn't get to you soon enough, so I apologize. You didn't even get the colored copies. But I want to start with this second page, this graph. This graph is really the key to what I'm thinking about. Do you have the graph? Do you have it?
Do we have
the... Yeah. You don't have this second page?
Second page, okay.
I won't go into it any detail.
The speaker is just coming in and out, and there's someone, I think, just juggling their papers by some microphone. And also, could you please tell me if we have her slides?
It should. We're converting it right now, and it should be up on Ola's, Senator.
I have a hard time getting OLIS where I am. Could you just email it? Is it this packet?
It's from CHCS.
Yeah.
All right. Well.
Yeah. That's the only document I received.
That's
PowerPoint.
Fine. I will. I have a handout that has a lot of the source material, but rather than load you with the source material, I'll just go through the talk and explain what I can on these graphs. And if
you
want,
can you hear better now, Senator?
I don't know that the microphone.
I'm not sure what.
Oh no, we have these. This is the phone microphone.
Oh. Well, why don't I just go over there?
That's easy.
Well, I need to crawl under the table.
We're just going to discuss it. We're going to do a little bring around the rosy here. And
can you hear me now?
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. Okay.
Kind of
well,
figured the microphone might help.
Musical chairs. All right. So I apologize for not having this graph, but I'm going to just tell you what this graph is. This talks about the degree of provider responsibility for mental health treatment and planning. I will explain later what level 0, level 1, level 2, and level 3 are, which are at the bottom. And what the axis, the vertical axis shows is level of complexity and what role primary care or a psychiatric consultant should play in delivering the care. I'll go past that right now. One of the source materials that I used is a study called Faces of Medicaid. It is a 100-page document that was funded by the N.E. Casey Foundation, and I'll get that to you by email. What they did was they looked at Medicaid expenditures and services provided to children and youth during the year 2005. The numbers that they have are not really any different nationwide at that time than they are statewide for us at this time. So I think it's a good source document for a lot more detail than I'm going to go into at this time. A couple of highlights. Children receiving behavioral health care represented less than 10% of the overall child population. So less than 10% of the Medicaid child population were getting behavioral health care, but they accounted for 38% of all the expenditures. 10% of the kids, 38% of the expenditures. The total mean Medicaid expenditures for children with behavioral health needs are primarily driven by behavioral, not physical or health service use. And I think that's an important thing to take into account. There's a chart in here that describes that. Since I don't have a PowerPoint to really go over that, basically that's what the chart demonstrates. These children are also typically involved in multiple agencies in addition to healthcare systems, juvenile justice, the educational system, special education, child welfare, foster system, DHS. That's expensive for the state when they are receiving services in multiple places. So what diagnoses are we treating? In this report, over 50% of the children have ADHD. About one quarter have conduct disorder. About one quarter have mood disorders. About one quarter have anxiety disorders. And then there's a miscellaneous group of about 11% that have developmental disabilities, psychosis, or other mental health issues. These don't necessarily add up to 100% because these are children who have one or more behavioral health care diagnoses, and frequently they do have more than one behavioral health diagnosis. So of these children, what behavioral services are used the most? There's a chart that demonstrates this, and it's a little hard for me to see, but outpatient treatment, primarily individual, is 53%. Psychotropic medication, 44%. Medication management, 27%. Screening and evaluation, 41%. So most of the services that are being used, individual therapy, medication management, screening and evaluation. If those are the services that we were using, what were we actually spending our money on? Most of the money went to residential treatment and therapeutic group homes. And I don't have percentages, but when you see the graph, you can see that that is the highest by far. It's twice as high as the next. The next one is substance abuse. The next one is inpatient psychiatric treatment, therapeutic foster care, therapeutic behavioral support, crisis intervention, and emergency rooms. So even though most of the services are really outpatient services, most of the money is being spent on higher levels of care. In the next chart, which you don't have, they talk about
We actually do have this.
Do you have this chart here?
We just didn't have the first one.
Okay. So this is the chart called Exhibit 14.
Okay.
On Exhibit 14, the behavioral health utilization for traditional versus promising services is looked at. Traditional services are those services that I described at first, outpatient treatment, medication management, evaluation, and assessment. Of the promising services that could benefit families, get services out into the community, out into the schools, where families are more involved, would include things like wraparound services, therapeutic foster care, respite care, supported housing, multisystemic therapy, which is for kids that are in the juvenile justice system and their families, and telemedicine or telehealth. So on the traditional services, where they're using 53, 44, 41, 22% of the dollars, the promising services were only using less than 10%. So as you create systems of care, even though the traditional services are a key part of taking care of children and youth, finding ways to create a scaffolded system, a multidisciplinary system, will help get these more promising services out into the community. So just to stop for a second and talk about how much medication are we giving children, since we're spending 44% of the dollars on psychotropic medications and 22% of the dollars on medication management. From the same report, and do you have this chart? Children receiving?
No.
Okay.
We have this one.
Oh. Yeah, that's it. Children receiving concurrent psychotropic medications by age. This, it's not blue on yours, but it's on this first one, shows that most of the kids are getting one medication, by and large, regardless of age. Most of them are on one medication. They'll be on an ADHD medication. They may be on an antidepressant. They may be on an anti-anxiety medication. But when you start to get to this overall, 22% are on two medications, 8.5% are on three medication, 2.2% are on four or more medication. These are the kids that are more complex, and those are the children and youth that I'm speaking to most. I think the kids that are on one medication They are fine to be managed by primary care doctors with as much psychiatric support as they want. They don't have to have a child psychiatrist to be treating necessarily. But when you start to get to 2, 3, 4 and more medications, these are complex kids. The next document that I use for a source document is from the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry. It is their best principles for integration of child psychiatry into the pediatric health home. I will give you at the end of my talk the actual article that's in this file, but just to review what they discuss. This is the chart again. Now, what they talk about in this model is level zero, which is preventative services and screening. This is applicable to all patients being seen in primary care practice to prevent and detect mental health problems. This isn't just in the primary care health home, but schools, community mental health programs, family support groups. There are any number of ways that kids will be identified that are at this level zero. These are primary care treatment kids that can be easily managed with as much support as primary care doctors or nurse practitioners or PAs might need. The second level is early intervention and routine care. This is for families and children with relatively uncomplicated but high prevalence behavioral health clinical problems. So in this chart you can see, by and large, most of the care, most of the evaluation can happen in the primary health home with some consultative service from child psychiatry specialists. Then you get to the more complex kids, and that's level two. Specialty consultation, treatment, and coordination. This is for kids that have intermediate level of risk, complex or severe mental health issues, or complicated family systems. And when you get to this level two, the recommendation by ACAP, American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, is that it be a split model, where half of the evaluation and services be managed by child psychiatry specialists and half be managed by primary care. That can be phone consultation, that can be evaluating the kids in a mental health office, but it's a shared responsibility. When you get to level three or level four, the most complicated, these are intensive mental health service for complex clinical problems. These are patients with defined behavioral health disorders, high level of risk, complexity or severity, requiring specialist consultation or intervention, and may include multi-system service teams. Quite frankly, I think that multi-system service teams is the way that we ought to go. I think that mental health teams that start at the ground level with licensed clinical social workers, master's level therapists, family therapists, people who can go out into the homes, out into the schools. I think that that is the first tier of mental health care that should be provided. I consult out at Mid-Columbia Center for Living, which is the community mental health program in Hood River, and I have to tell you, they have an excellent program. And the reason it is so great is they're out in the schools, they go out into the homes, they do family therapy, they do drug and alcohol. And the kids that are complex, that can't be managed well or comfortably in the primary care offices, those are the ones that get referred to me. So I do the complex evaluations. I do see adults as well as kids in that program. Make the diagnosis, get the treatment started, stabilize them, and then they go back out to the primary care offices. Now, some primary care providers are not comfortable with some of the more complex cases, but by and large, I'd say probably 60% of the cases that I evaluate there can then be managed out in the primary care offices. The one group that I haven't mentioned in this, and I have to say, Robin Henderson, I don't mention the psychologists. And I think that the role of psychologists in evaluation and treatment is probably underutilized. When I was a primary care doctor, when I had somebody with a mental health problem that wasn't simple anxiety, it wasn't simple unipolar depression, I had a variety of psychologists that I referred to and a variety of licensed clinical social workers who handled the mental health piece and sometimes helped me diagnostically. and help me decide, you know, is this actually something I should be managing, or is this something that should be managed by a psychologist or managed by a psychiatrist? So I think that the scaffolding of what the care system should look like is multi-level. And David Conant Norville can talk about the program that he has in his office and describe that a little bit better. So I'll conclude with what my recommendations are. My recommendations are about these kids that are in the level 2, level 3. Multiple medications, multiple different diagnoses, complex family systems, kids that have arrived in the juvenile justice system because of mental health issues. These are kind of the Kathy Flagle recommendations, but I do represent Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, so if I'm out of line, I know they'll slap me down at the next meeting. So I think that screening for mental health concerns, regardless of what kind of system you have, regardless if it's a Peace Health, regardless if it is a mental health focused team, regardless of whether it is a CCO or a primary care health home, screening for mental health concerns can start with online tools, master's level trained personnel, psychologists, nurses, physician's assistants, nurse practitioners, primary care doctors. Initial screening, anybody can be doing that, even in the schools. The second thing is multidisciplinary teams should triage the evaluation to the appropriate level of provider, depending on complexity. A child psychiatrist has had 6 years of supervised psychotherapy training. They've had 4 months of neurology. They've had 4 months in child psychiatry of inpatient psychiatry. They've had 4 months of working in a residential treatment program. They have had 4 months of working in the schools. So the training that they have sets them up to be the best for the really complex cases. But I think you need a triage team that sits down and says, these are the cases that came in. Let's figure out who should be doing the evaluations, because psychiatrists don't have to see every mental health problem that comes through the door. Any patient considered level 3 or 4 should be evaluated by a child psychiatrist or a psychiatric nurse practitioner with psychiatric consultation or supervision. If they're complex, they should be doing this in a team approach. And I think that psychiatrists have to change what we do to make ourselves more available for that. Then regular disciplinary meetings should be set up to assess patient progress and readiness to move to a lower level of care, which is exactly what we do at Mid-Columbia Center for Living. I do a complex evaluation, we get them stabilized, and then we decide as a team, when are they ready to go back to the primary care doctor or be managed by the therapist with very little need to be seeing a child psychiatrist. I think we should remove barriers that prevent any patient from seeking care in the county community mental health centers, regardless of insurance. One of the things I see out at Hood River is a patient that really could benefit from their multidisciplinary team, but because of insurance barriers that, frankly, I can't really describe, they don't get seen there. And so you've got a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant sitting in their primary care office. They've got a case that I'd be glad to see. And frankly, it'd be the most efficient thing for them, but they can't get into those centers. So we have community mental health centers in every county, and we should be using them. By the way, I want to mention Mike Franz, who is the chairman or the president of OCAP, couldn't be here today because he's out at Harney County seeing kids and providing consultation and supervision. So I'm here for Mike. My next recommendation is that rural and underserved areas have immediate access to child psychiatry via OPAL-K. Online psychiatric access line for kids was funded by the legislature, and we are beginning to, in the next few weeks, we will start taking phone calls. I think there are some targeted primary care groups that we will start with, but we ultimately will be serving CCOs and I think probably any primary care provider out there who has a question. The reason this is such a great service is you don't have to have a child psychiatrist in a mobile van driving around the state. We can pick up the phone. They will get an immediate consultation. So they call, I pick up the phone, we go over the case. In addition, there will be telepsychiatry evaluations for foster kids. So a one-time psychiatric evaluation for foster kids. It can be done by telepsychiatry, so any kid in the state can be seen by a child psychiatrist through Opal K. And I think that more telemedicine psychiatry in general, I think, is a good place to put money when you're thinking about funding these services. The last thing I want to say is we need to redesign psychiatric training to better meet consultative, supervisory, and systems of care leadership needed in primary care medical homes, community mental health programs, and state advisory roles. As an assistant professor training child psychiatrists, this is the direction that I am starting to lead these young people, because seeing patients individually in your office is an inefficient system. You will never find a child psychiatrist who doesn't want to see some patients that are their patients. But as I do, I see some of my own patients. I do acute consultations at OHSU when somebody's been in the emergency room but doesn't need to be admitted but needs to be seen in a few days. I go out to Hood River to see patients there, and I'll be doing telepsychiatry in Opal K. So I think training psychiatrists for multiple roles is going to be the future of child psychiatry. And the last thing I want to say is, in case you didn't know it, psychiatrists already provide direct patient care via telepsychiatry to outlying communities. Umatilla County, Wallowa, I don't know if that's a county, Tillamook is the county, sorry. But there are already people who are doing telepsychiatry and going out to these communities. There are psychiatrists that travel across the strait, the state. Mike Franz is out in Harney County today. And then the online psychiatric access line for kids. I will pass out this to all of you, which is not my PowerPoint directly, but it'll tell you about the best principles for child psychiatry in the pediatric health home. There's also an article in here, various state approaches, four different state approaches to integrating physical and behavioral health services for Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries, early insights. Opal K is in here, and finally my thank you to the task force for allowing me to participate and speak with you. Dr. Kincaid, especially thank you to you for a chance to sit down over dinner and talk about things. And on behalf of the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, we welcome future opportunities to contribute with ideas or our time to create better systems for the benefit of children and families in Oregon. And with that, I will stop and pass this off
to... Can
we do
questions first?
Yeah. Yes.
Question? Question and comment, and Senator Monitor Sanderson, this is Robin Henderson from the great area of the state called Central Oregon. Central Oregon.
Do you need this?
No, I have one right here.
Okay.
Senator, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, fine.
Fabulous. I want to tell you a little bit about Central Oregon and ask your help, because I'm a little bit kind of confused. I come from a part of the region that has about 250,000 people, 22,000 Medicaid children, 1,380 of which have complex health care needs, children with complex health care needs who are on the Medicaid plan right now, although that number's probably grown in the last 2 months, most of which our numbers are the same as your numbers.
Right.
I've dived into the psychopharmacology. I've seen all those things. But let me tell you what it's like on the Medicaid plan in Central Oregon. I have zero child psychiatrists in Central Oregon, in my entire region, with my three counties, who are willing to take Medicaid, unless it is somebody in our ER or on our pediatric service. Last fall, I reached out to OHSU, went up with a group of physicians, and said, we are in desperate need of someone to come and help us, anyone to come and help us, to consult with our pediatric clinic. We have all of these children here, three county mental health clinics. We are in desperate need, and they said, we have no bandwidth to help you. None. The only providers who have been willing to step up and see the Medicaid patients in our community have been the psychiatric nurse practitioners. And they have been a lifeline for many of us to see very, very complicated children. I appreciate that you've got folks in Harney and all those other places. But I'm telling you, from boots on the ground, I've been in Central Oregon for 12 years. I've been recruiting child psychiatry. When I'm able to get a child psychiatrist in, they will see Medicaid in the hospital. They will only see private pay in the community, and I've been in active recruitment now for more than 2 years. It is desperately frustrating for my pediatrics department. You have no idea how many days that I walk into my hospital and there are groups of pediatricians, and I have two boys, 11 and 13, so I got to work with these guys professionally too because they take care of my children who seem to break bones every time I turn around. And it's uncomfortable to be sitting there with your kid with a cracked finger with a pediatrician you know is upset because you can't provide them any form of pediatric assistance. Right now, in my ER, Monday morning, well, no, it was Tuesday morning, 8-year-old boy admitted to our ER, so out of control, so violent, does not have Medicaid, so the county will not see him. So he has no wrap services. He's not enrolled in school. The parents have done everything they can. He's been to Portland to see the psychiatric unit. They were done with him. They discharged him back. There's no wrap services. There's no child psychiatrist willing to take him. He's on day 3 in a safe room in my ER because we can't figure out what else to do with him. We are dying. And I'm sitting in a position where the only thing that I've been able to provide support, the only thing I've been able to do, is to embed psychologists in my pediatrics clinics to at least be able to see some of the relief. They can't give them any medication advice, but at least be able to be there as a mental health person helping them out and doing what it is that they can. How? I appreciate everything you're telling me. That's the nirvana. I want to go to the multidisciplinary dream. I've been trying to build that. How do I get there when the workforce isn't there to support it? What's going to change and how are you going to help us there?
I think that the world of the individual psychiatrist in an office is going to change.
I agree.
I think that, and it's going to be uneven. There will be psychiatrists who stay in that model, but there are going to be psychiatrists who are going to be much happier in a multidisciplinary team. Now, right now, I can say, I don't know if Bend is one of the early primary care clinics that Opal K is going to be serving. Keith Cheng is...
I've heard rumors that they are going to look at one of our clinics.
Yeah, so
I haven't
it's
heard
a start.
Key.
Yeah, it's a start. But I agree. I think that if there is a model where a child psychiatrist can be in the community without the barriers, frankly, it's complicated to see a child on OHP. The paperwork that you have to fill out to see an OHP patient is prohibitive. You spend more time in the office on the paperwork and on the phone than you do seeing the patient. So as you create systems of care, that's got to get easier. And if the kids are coming through the CCO, it seems to me that the CCO can contract with child psychiatrists to be coming out, just like I go to Hood River.
We've tried. We can't find any. I went to the best. I went to OHSU. Through ourselves, I took a group of docs. Help us, please, anybody. We tried.
Well, I don't have the answer exactly, but...
I feel the need to interject here. I apologize, but I think that's... I'm talking...
And I don't mean to hijack with the regional issue, but this is the boots on the ground problem that our hospitals and our primary care docs and our pediatricians are living with every day in an area that is not served at all by child psychiatry, and that's sure. What's difficult.
Sure, and I, first of all, my name is Dr. Daniel Dick. I'm a psychiatrist at Oregon State Hospital. I'm an assistant professor at Oregon Health and Sciences University.
Yeah, who take the microphone.
Is contracted.
You want to talk into that?
We're just talking about
this. Why don't you sit in the next seat, because then you won't have any trouble.
I am contracted to Oregon State Hospital via OHSU. And I've been doing inpatient for the past 3.5 to 4 years. I'm also forensically trained. So just to get that on the table. I don't have a lot of information about child psychiatry in terms of why they're not in rural Oregon. I believe that is why we're here as an organization, as a committee. That's why we're here as these members of our organization, and you guys are here as a committee to help figure out how can we implement care for all Oregonians all over the state, right? So... The difficulty is there's funding barriers, there are economic and social realities that go with the fact that Oregon is such a large place and the population is mostly attuned to Portland, to Ashland, I think, maybe Eugene may be a better call, but the I-5 corridor, as we call it. And I think what I was going to speak to was the collaborative care model, which is a model that Jürgen Unser speaks of at University of Washington. And there's three parts to this model. It's a primary care home, and there's a team that is organized to do wraparound services for individuals, and then a psychiatric consultant. And I believe if we are truly going to move away from fee-for-service to a care model that is not fee-for-service, and I can't think of what I wanted to say about that. But
for value? Alternative payment methodology?
Yes, exactly. capping the services, but having a contracted physician to come participate. The difficulty is, and I've graduated residency here in 2009, did the fellowship in 2010. I've been on the legislative committee for a few years now. I've been hearing comments like this forever. I've been reading about them in the newspaper. I know the good people at Oregon, you know, OHSU and the pediatric psychiatry department. So it's hard to hear that there's the perception that psychiatrists aren't doing enough. And I don't know individual psychiatrists who work in Bend beyond folks I've talked to at St. Charles, but my hope is that we will move past this. And I think we're working on that with Opal K. I think telemedicine is a future. And I think the reminder that we're here. As David said to me this morning, Dr. Conant Norville said, you're the future of psychiatry in this state. That's a pretty heavy burden to bear, but that's why I'm here, because I want to hear that message and figure out, well, how can we get care to Bend? Bend's a great place.
Tell me about it.
And then what about what's beyond Bend, right? And why can't, and the reason, I think, I don't know if I need to tell this committee, why would physicians not take a Medicare or Medicaid patient and outpatient? There are lots of thoughts to that, and that's the problem we have, is these barriers to people receiving payment, the amount of time it takes to do the paperwork, and how many patients can you see in a certain amount of time if you're spending more time doing paperwork.
So how concerned are you about the issue that when you look on the physical side of the health plan, and this is one of the bigger funding concerns that we deal with every day, on the physical side of the health plan for Medicaid, even though we're in a CCO and they're blended, I get it, but it's not really that way, they're still separate, and we know it.
Right.
On the physical side of the health plan, any willing provider who is willing to take Medicaid can take Medicaid. But on the mental health side of the plan, we still live in a system where community mental health controls the dollar, and any willing licensed provider in the state is not eligible and cannot, regardless of the amount of paperwork that they fill out, because you have all of these certification rules. Now, there is a rule that's lifted that and has said that any willing provider now, any licensed provider can, but as any licensed provider knows, that's still at the approval of community mental health. How are we going to work together to break that down so maybe we can encourage people? Because I think people would see them. I actually do. Inherently, I think people want to do the right thing. But we've got to get to the point of breaking down those barriers, and that's what I hear you saying, is those pieces of those barriers that need to come
right down. And I think it's a twofold thing, and my work in the state hospital is collaborative care. I work with a social worker, I work with psychologists, I work with nurse practitioners, I work with nurses, and we have treatment care plan specialists, there's a lot I've learned on the fly about collaborative care coming out of residency. But that's not to say I wasn't introduced to this model in residency. And I know for sure, because I'm an assistant professor working with the public psychiatry department, that we are encouraging more people to consider not only the public psychiatry realm, but understanding that your job is no longer, I'm going to go and be the next Freud in an office on Main Street, which can happen and should happen because we are American, we all want freedom of choice and we want those sorts of things, but that our numbers don't add up. We've gone, I think, that Dr. George Keepers, who's the chairman of our psychiatry department at OHSU, made a point that in the early 1970s, psychiatrists were 25% of the mental health workforce. Now we're below 10%. So we understand, and I'm not going to be the one speaking for a whole generation of new psychiatrists, but I think most of us understand that there aren't enough of us to do the care we'd like to do if we could do it right. So we're hoping, would like to move forward with the idea that we have a model that takes away the barrier of the funding. But the reality is we also need to make the position attractive for psychiatrists, because we spend a lot of time learning to do what we do, and we get a lot of good ideas from that. And so having a model where we can be direct care providers and also consultants to the process would be very useful. And I don't have an answer for why a child psychiatrist won't see a patient out and so forth. But I think we're the whole point of the CCO model is to move away from that completely.
So there's one last thought then. Part of what I think the solution is, and I want your opinion on this, psychiatrists, yes, are very well trained and very well prepared for this work. So are psychologists, so are psychiatric nurse practitioners. And how do we get past some of these scope issues to get into where we can use everybody at the top of their license and begin to say, okay, it doesn't have to be, maybe it's not going to be a psychiatrist in my community. But what is your opinion on using some of the other disciplinaries in a more holistic fashion? And then
I think that's a very good question, and I think that's another reason why we're here, because I think scope of practice is a conversation that not many of us really would like to focus on at this point, because we want to move forward to what's the scope of practice for treating the patient and for everyone involved. And I think what that means is psychiatry programs, nurse practitioner programs, PA programs, psychology programs all need to start training each other to think alike. And one of the difficulties with scope of practice is we have nurses are under the nursing board, physicians are under the Board of Medicine. And both of those organizations have their own standards for how care should be done. There's also the training process that occurs for nurse practitioners, and this is just two examples, and for physicians. And physicians follow the medical model. That doesn't mean nurses don't follow the medical model. It's that the conversations that occur within that model are not the same. So a conversation that I have with a nurse practitioner, until I get to know them and I understand how they practice, is different than the conversation I would have with an internal medicine physician right off the bat. So we have that dilemma. And then we have the fact that, well, the years I spend being trained is different than the years someone else does. So that's not necessarily a bad thing. And I can't even say my, 10 years in training is better or more diverse than someone else's 2 years in training, because I can't say their first 2 years was my first 2 years. So we have to find a way to make it a universal understanding that, okay, I bring something to the table as a psychiatrist, but so do other people. And then there's the fact that some individuals get along with individual patients better than others. And I think Dr. Conan Norville actually can speak to this more directly, given that his working model is exactly this. How does he bring people in who have different training and then learn how to communicate with them or help them understand how to communicate with him?
Dr. Gluckman, you had a comment.
Yeah, I just want to bring us back to, you know, this is a really complicated issue when we're talking about how to deliver services for people, but one of the purposes of the task force is to talk about how we reimburse for services in an equitable fashion. Mm-hmm. And I just want to bring us back to the issue is that we're having some challenges with how we define equity. You know, what's an equitable service? And what is being described by Drs. Dick and Flagel is that there is a hierarchy of patient need based on the acuity of the patient population, and the coding system that is currently in place doesn't really match up well with that. And so just as we kind of go forward and hear about the complexity, I think one of the things that wouldn't serve the public well is that we pay more for low acuity services and don't devote the resources to the high acuity services that people have trouble accessing. And one of the reasons, you know, as Robin pointed out, is that in some communities, although we have CCOs, we still have separation of mental and physical health. But then the danger is that I think many of in child psychiatry, and I'm not a child psychiatrist, I'm an internist, but my bias, you know, which I correct me if I'm wrong, is that some of the most complex cases patients in children are in Medicaid, and Medicaid is a low payer. And if we have to kind of deal with payment equity without recognizing the acuity and devoting the resources to those kids' needs, we're never going to get a workforce that's going to do what those kids need, because they're going to be providing low acuity care that pays better someplace else. And we are going to have to wrap our hands around that, and that's the type of advice I think that the legislature needs, and we can't get hung up on what equity means without really accounting for the acuity of the patient population, because people will suffer.
Corey, you had a comment.
Yeah, I do. Coralie Koning, physician assistant. It's one particular population that we don't talk a lot about with psychiatry, but we do have psychiatrically trained PAs. We have a fellowship program. We have a postgraduate program as well. Something to think about in your rural areas, since we have a lot of PAs in the rural areas of Oregon now. So with something about, you know, numbers of needing people, if we need more people, let's maybe think about even a PA program out of the OHSU as a fellowship in psychiatry. Something to think about, you know. But that is something that is a possibility to increase numbers as well. I don't have numbers for you as how many psychiatric PAs we have. I know there are very few in the whole United States, and in Oregon there are even fewer, but I believe it's because we just don't have the training programs that are more robust and particularly, you know, placed in the PA programs.
In the essence of time, I just want to make, we have two more speakers, Dr. Dick and Dr. Conan-Norville. We need to sort of move it along here, as we say in the business. Sure.
Well, I'm trying to think if I just said what I need to say, because I think essentially that the only point that I really haven't brought up in my response, I think, was that I do believe that psychiatrists are uniquely suited to be in the collaborative care model that has been proven to be the most successful in treating these patients. And I say that because we have a breadth of training that is, you know, related to our gold standard of the evaluation, which is the biological, psychological, and social exam, biopsychosocial. And so I just ask the committee that in the process of establishing the role of psychiatry within a new funded and treatment model, that you appreciate that we can bring a lot to the table. Not that you don't necessarily, but I'm just here to remind you that be sure to do that.
Oh, we appreciate that. Any other comments for Dr. Dick? All right.
Hi. My name is Dave Conant-Norville. I'm a child psychiatrist, lifelong Oregonian, grew up in southeast Portland. Kept going to California, kept coming back for medical school, went down there due to family practice, said, family practice is too hard, I talk too long, I have to come back to Oregon to do psychiatry and child psychiatry. I've been here ever since. After graduating from the OHSU and the fellowship program, child psychiatry, I had a two-year obligation in the National Service Corps and fortunately was set up in Pendleton. And so I was there for 6 years and only reluctantly left because my two grandmothers died and I moved up the chain and my parents were in Portland. But I've been going to Pendleton ever since 1987, and I go there every week, every Tuesday. So I have a lot of experience in providing care in rural areas. I continue to do it. I tried to set up a clinic there with a nurse practitioner and a therapist, and then I would come in, and unfortunately a nurse practitioner went out of practice, and the therapist didn't want to travel from Walla Walla, so I now bring a developmental pediatrician with me on Seaport Air every Tuesday, and we do video conferencing, and I've been doing video conferencing in Pendleton since they had POTS, plain old telephone service, and these little tiny things. And, in Pendleton, I developed I worked as the medical director of a psychiatric residential treatment program for 17 years called Pendleton Academies, and we closed down when the state went to a different model. But so I have a lot of experience with high-end kids and kids on Medicare and kids that have failed in every setting. I've worked at inpatient program at St. Vincent Hospital for Adolescents until they closed the program in the mid-90s. I have practiced outpatient psychiatry in Pendleton in a partnership practice. I've consulted as the consultant for the Umatilla County at Yellowhawk. I've worked as a consultant for Umatilla County Mental Health for all the years I was in Pendleton. I spent 12 years, one day a week, as a consultant for LifeWorks Northwest, as their child psychiatrist. Quite frankly, one day is about all I can tolerate of that, so that gives you sort of a hint. I'm medical director of Youth Contact, which is a family therapy program in Washington County that provides services for kids and adolescents, mainly family therapy, but also has services in the home, level 4 kids, and services in the schools with school-based therapists. And so I've been doing that for about 8 years. So I have a lot of experience in a lot of different areas. One of the things that I did with partner, and then we've developed over the last, since 9/11 actually, 2001, is we developed a practice called Mind Matters PC. And the concept of the practice was that we were going to develop a multidisciplinary practice in Washington County that would be a service to primary care physicians who would make referrals in primary care primarily, but also schools, and that we would develop a treatment team that would be able to meet the needs, and so that the primary care physicians wouldn't have to figure out, do I send this person to a therapist, do I send this person to a psychiatrist, do I send this person to a psychologist, a nurse practitioner, where do I send this person? And so we've been working on that, and in 2007, I was president of the Oregon Council of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and we developed an initiative with the Oregon Psychiatric Service to collaborate as psychologists, as pediatricians and child psychiatrists to figure out how we could work together more. And we've developed this process, and we've had a lot of stakeholders involved in these discussions. So this has been an ongoing discussion for quite some time, and it's culminating with Opal K. So there's awareness of the problem. What I wanted to talk about a little bit is the model that we've developed, because we have 13 years experience at Mind Matters with a multidisciplinary team, and how it works, and then some of the challenges financially of running a program, since I'm an owner there. So right now we have 5 physicians, we have 2 nurse practitioners, we have 3 therapists, master's level therapists. We found that it's very hard to recruit young doctors. Very hard. We lose out to Kaiser all the time. And we recruit them, we bring them in, they say, oh, I'd love to work here. And then they go to Kaiser. And this has been going on. Do you have the same thing?
No, mine actually end up staying at OHSU.
Oh. it's like we're losing, but we keep trying. And quite frankly, we have decided in our practice that, first of all, we've been a child psychiatry practice, and we're going to do adult psychiatry, partly because kids come with lots of adults, and the adults have psychiatric problems they need to be cared for. And also, we have this whole cadre of these transitional age kids that we just don't have enough. They're very complex, and we don't have enough child psychiatrists, and we'll never have enough child psychiatrists. And so we're trying to sort of expand our talent pool. But then we're finding that we have to recruit nationally. And this is a hard pill to swallow because it's so expensive, but it's going to cost about $25,000 to $27,000 per psychiatrist to bring them in. You have the same drill? And it's just like, it's a lot of money. Not only that, is when we try to bring in young psychiatrists, they have a $300,000 debt they have to pay. So they already own a house. That's called their education. And so they're trying to figure out how they're going to make a lot of money fast, because they have this debt, and they have, they're young, and they want to buy a house, and they have a young family. And so it makes it really hard to sort of say, yeah, well, we're not, can't pay as much because we're going to do Medicaid. And we have a lot of business, especially in Washington County, just for folks with insurance. We've enjoyed having nurse practitioners in our practice. And partly, and I, like I said, we tried to have a nurse practitioner in Pendleton as well, partly because we engage with them and they can extend our capacity to provide care. Now, nurse practitioners, they have a lot of capacity. They're, quite frankly, the best nurses, and we have actually nurses in our office, too, that take care of a lot of important medical processes that psychiatrists don't have to do. The nurse practitioners are somewhat limited, unfortunately, in what they can do. That's why we have them in our office. We supervise them directly. We go over difficult cases every week. We have our intakes that are referred by primary care. We go over those twice a week with our whole team. We hand them out to people. We talk about the case. We figure out who's the best person for the case. And then we have all the nurse practitioners. They can catch us in the hallway. They can catch us anywhere. We have therapists, because one of the things that nurse practitioners don't get is all the psychotherapy treatment or training that we feel is very important. And so we have therapists that provide that. And then we've tried to focus on certain models of treatment so that we have the same language across disciplines. Even with this fairly small group, it's a very complex thing. So having a multidisciplinary team is not easy. At Youth Contact, where they do Medicaid kids and kids without insurance and kids that are undocumented, they can survive because they have unlicensed therapists. And so they can pay very little money to unlicensed therapists, but then the therapists get licensed and then they leave. And so it's a very difficult situation there, because they have very complex kids with very severe psychosocial difficulties and a lot of trauma. And they are trying to use a family therapy model and trying to train these folks right out of graduate school how to do therapy and then bring them into me. What I insist on there is that when we do an evaluation, that the therapist is sitting right by me and that we're doing this together. And every time I see a person, the therapist is with me, and that we're training the therapist as we take care of the patient. So that works, and I found that worked at Umatilla County as well. At LifeWorks, it was terrible in my mind, because I never saw the therapists, and the therapists were the connection to the patient. So if you develop sort of a system that's relatively low cost, and you have a person connected that maybe isn't even licensed but is getting experience, it's hard to train that person if they're not even in the room with you. So one of the things that we do at our office, even when we our rooms are right next door, so we're always in connection with each other. So it allows us to bring our nurse practitioners up to the highest level of their training, and then hopefully beyond them. Because I'll put a couple of my nurse practitioners against some psychiatrists, because they know what they do, and they know what they don't do, and they have clear limits, and they ask for help. So we've benefited greatly from having nurse practitioners in their role, and they've helped us to clarify what their role is. We think that the role of psychiatrist is the role of clinical leader. And I want to
talk about sort of some of the stuff that that Kathy's talked about too, is that we do need to do consultation. We do need to do leadership in care development. We historically, you know, I think psychiatrists have been isolated, and there's, so you're a psychiatrist here, everybody wants their own private practice. And I agree with Kathy that that is not a viable long-term model. To improve care, however, we need to make sure that we first of all train the talent, and in my mind, having a small child psychiatry fellowship program and a relatively small adult psychiatry program at OHSU, and now a little tiny one in Corvallis, is inadequate, because we're just hoping that we can attract people to Oregon. But what we found is that the funding here and what we can pay a psychiatrist and child psychiatrist is not what is getting paid to people nationally. So we have a hard time attracting them. So I think if we can train more and expand the OHSU program and the Corvallis program, and train folks locally, we can build our manpower. And those are the leaders. I think that we can expand, the pie can get bigger, because we are not scratching the surface on trying to take care of the needs of our families and adults. I think that, you know, we can expand training programs in as nurse practitioners in psychiatry too. It's a relatively small program here. We have in our office, we're doubling the size of our office. We're going to be moving in an office that's 13,000 square feet, has 20 offices, and I think we'll have every office filled within 2 years. Then what? Well, then we go to Bend. Or maybe we start right now. But you know, the point is, how do we develop a payment structure that acknowledges how we organize care? Because right now it's disorganized. It, you know, psychiatrists say, well, I'll stay small and I'll protect myself because I can be shift around. You know, I'll get contracts here and a contract there, or I'll just, you know, I'll do a little bit of this, a little bit of that. But unfortunately, they tend to not be in the same group for long periods of time. And I think that if you develop a payment model that acknowledges group practices and helps people within groups, we can, I mean, you know, if we had payment for large groups of care, and if we had the data to figure out what it costs, then we can assign how we're going to do care to different people, and we can transition people, and we can connect with primary care. I spent 3 years every Wednesday going to Westside Pediatrics just to find out what I could do as a psychiatrist in their office, and I saw consultations. They just sort of send consultations my way. I found, well, it really wasn't cost effective, and if I'm going to be able to float my own practice, I have to bill a lot so I can pay other people. But it was, I learned a lot, and I think that the pediatricians learned a lot. And one of the things I learned is that, you know, most of the folks in primary care that the pediatricians see, they need direct consultation. There's no mechanism for them to call us, and other than we're all friends, and they call me, and what should we do? And we give them a curbside. But there's no payment mechanism to formally pay for consultation direct to primary care docs. And so primary care docs realize this, and they're busy, and they don't. So they don't do it. They don't want to offend us or take too much of our time because we're hard to get. And there are models where that is not the case. In Minnesota, for example, there's a model where primary care docs can pay or get, they can charge insurance companies to call a psychiatrist for consultation, and they get paid. And through the payment, they pay their consultant, whatever the fee is. It's not a ton of money, but it's something.
And, you know, so those are the mechanisms. I do video conferencing to my office in Pendleton. We do video conferencing often to college students. You know, we do it basically because the law says we can do it now, but we don't get any more payment. It costs more money to actually to do that, especially if you have an office in Pendleton that you're running, you have a person in the office, and you're running, you know, the Polycom system there, and then I have a Polycom system in my office in Beaverton. You know, while it costs more money to provide that kind of care, we don't get paid more money for it. You know, so what's the incentive? Well, because we want to do it. But I think that when you're thinking of how much it, you know, how to set up the financial package, you have to think about these kind of things. Because money sort of drives decision making, and that's why we're all here, right? I hope that there's a couple things. First of all, that we...
I say we certainly need to wrap it up.
Okay, I could go on forever, so I'm not going to. The bottom line is I think we just need more psychiatrists, we need more training, we need more training for mental health folks, and that we need to work... we need to develop models that pay people to work collaboratively.
Thank you. Any questions for Dr. All right. Thank you very much. So at this point, I think we'll go ahead and call our nurse practitioners up. So I'm happy to introduce Linda Morley, who's a mental health nurse practitioner. She's also part of the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon Legislative Committee as well. And also as well, Madeline Simmons, who's a psych mental health nurse practitioner. Thank you, ladies, for being here this morning.
Okay. My name is Linda Morley. I'm a psychiatric mental health nurse practitioner in private practice here in Salem. A few things I just kind of want to start with. It was my understanding that House Bill 2902 deals only with commercial insurance companies. So that is what I'm prepared to talk about today. However, I have a real passion for public mental health, and I worked in public mental health for many years before I went into private practice. I support almost everything that was said earlier today, and I have a whole lot of ideas of my own, and I could go on for hours about those. I am a huge fan of the multidisciplinary system. That is what I did when I was in public mental health. And I want to say that in the office I'm in currently, we have three other psych nurse practitioners, and I'm grateful to my colleagues who were able to come in today and support me. We also have psychologists, social workers, and I don't think we have a master's level therapist at this time, but we have in the past. All of this started, at least from my point of view, about 4 years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, when insurance companies suddenly slashed the reimbursement rates to all mental health providers, with the exception of psychiatrists. I am grateful that some of my psychologist colleagues are here today. My next project is to fully support them in being able to achieve a fair rate, and I could go on about that for a very long time because I have seen what it has done to the ability of patients in this area to be able to get care, because so many of us in the mental health field have either retired, have left, have gone to the public sector, or who have just gotten frustrated and gone away. Unfortunately, I believe that behavioral health or mental health has for many years, probably from its inception, been the neglected stepchild of medical care. And I think most of you in this field would thank you for the head nods. I think most of you working here would completely agree. My remarks today are a little bit all over the map, but there are a number of things I want to share about, but I will try to be succinct. Let me go back to one of the things that I know that all of my colleagues and I want to be very, very, we want to affirm, is that our beef is not with psychiatrists. Every one of us has worked with psychiatrists. I do want to maybe correct some misconceptions that I've heard today. First of all, the nurse practitioners are in no way limited by what they do. I can tell you that the psychiatrists that I have worked with in both public mental health and in the private sector I can do every single thing that they do. Some have specialized training. Maybe they do transcranial magnetic stimulation. I haven't received that training. But I know many of the psychiatrists here in town, and many of my colleagues work in the same offices with them, and I can tell you that we see the same patients, the same severity. Our pay up to this point has been quite different, and I'm going to tell you also about some things that have happened since the first of the year with the insurance companies that I do not believe are compliant with what 2902 has intended to do. Anyway, so that's one. Psychiatric nurse practitioners who are licensed and certified do not require any supervision at all. None. As I say, we practice exactly as the psychiatrists do. There are changes in different settings. In the state hospital, it's different. I have a colleague here today who works in the correction system, in the state correction system. I don't believe that she receives supervision from any psychiatrist. Is that right? That's correct. Okay. Contrary to what you were told earlier, we do receive training in psychotherapy, and some of us are qualified to deal with very complicated psychotherapy issues. I currently have at least 5 patients who have dissociative identity disorder. All right, so full disclosure, I will be retiring before this bill sunsets. So I'm not going to stand to benefit in any way that I'm aware of unless I can get somebody to pay me for this work that we're doing. And I'm very nervous. Let me drink some. And let me tell you a little bit about my experience. I received my first professional license in 1974. I think there are people in this room who weren't born then. So I've been working in this field since 1974. I have 9 years of training. From day one, registered nurses are trained in the biopsychosocial model. From day one. This did not used to be true in medicine, but this is what we've had from day one, and I will say that these are registered nurses in every field, not just mental health. In the spring, this spring will mark my 21st year in private practice. Let me go back and do this chronologically. I graduated in 71. I worked in obstetrics for a few years, and then I went to Africa, and for 6 years I worked in a very remote bush area where I was the only health practitioner for a population of about 15,000. The nearest medical facility was a 4-hour drive away, assuming that the rivers weren't in flood. So I am qualified to suture the foot of somebody who tried to chop it off when they were using an axe. I have delivered babies. I have organized massive immunization programs where we immunize thousands and thousands of children for all of the illnesses such as measles and tuberculosis that so many children had died of. Physicians from the States would come over to spend time with me to learn about tropical medicine. The insurance companies don't care a bit that I have all that training and experience. And so sometimes in these discussions I have heard that really physicians, again, I'm not, you know, I don't even want to say physicians. Let's just say any kind of mental health nurse practitioner. The fact that we have training in many other areas and almost everybody did, like you heard. Some people have worked in private practice. One of my colleagues was worked and continues to treat, she's an adult nurse practitioner. She can work in general medicine, and she does, even though she's also a psych nurse practitioner. We all have training and experience in areas that the insurance companies are not paying us for. So, I wanted, yesterday, because one of the things I wanted to focus on was what is the current status of access to care in the greater Salem area, since that's where I work. So I placed calls to the offices of all 11 psychiatrists in private practice here in Salem yesterday. This was very eye-opening. I am very glad I did this. Now, I didn't call all the psych nurse practitioners because I already know what they do. So I called, and I talked either with the psychiatrist themselves or with their staff. And I want to tell you, I got an earful. And none of it had anything to do with payment parity for psychiatric nurse practitioners. When they heard that I would be here today, they started telling me all the things that they hoped that I would share with this task force, and I am going to get to that. So more about my conversations with them yesterday. Now let me tell you a little bit about how we are now reimbursed. For years and years, for I would say 18, 19 years of the time that I have been in private practice, insurance companies have paid me based on the amount of time that I spend with the patient. So for example, an average visit for a patient who's doing well is usually 15 to 30 minutes. When I first entered private practice in 1993, I received $65 to $85 for that service based on depending on the insurance company. Today, if I see the very same patient with the new higher rates that we now have because of House Bill 2902, I now receive about $75 to $79. I am so fortunate. So, you know, I got to say that as I've listened to everyone talk, as awful as it is to admit, I think that a lot of the reason that we don't have more people in working in public mental health has to do with the two P's, payment and paperwork. Every one of my colleagues, maybe one exception, would love to work with public mental health clients. Almost every one of us worked in public mental health before we moved to this field. We cannot afford to. And even more frustrating is the amount of paperwork and all the hoops we have to jump through. Because I have a passion for working with people who aren't able to be insured, for several years now, I have also been volunteering in my free time to see psychiatric patients at the free medical clinic here in town. I have seen patients from Bend. Anybody in the state can come and see me for free. The majority of our patients were rolled over into the Oregon Health Plan at the first of the year. I am still seeing Oregon Health Plan patients because they can't get in anywhere else. And we expect to continue to be busy for a while so that patients are not abandoned. So with the codes, what changed then last year is that we now, rather than having a code that we used that said how much time we spent with a patient, we had other codes that we could use that would describe the complexity of the patient. This has been wonderful. And I'll tell you, for someone who actually strangely likes statistics, I think this really makes good sense so that we can more accurately see what it is that we're dealing with in these areas. In medicine, they had been this way for quite a while. So unfortunately, one of the things that happened was that that when my colleagues and I began to receive the new fee schedules at the beginning of this year, we noticed that some of the codes were left off the schedule. So here's an example of what that means to us in real practice. This week, my colleagues and I received a new fee schedule from one company and discovered that they had simply deleted the codes we use for our more seriously ill and complicated patients. In other words, we would be paid less. This means that when I see a complicated patient with multiple illnesses who's also being treated by a primary care practitioner, a neurologist, and an endocrinologist, all of whom I want to coordinate care with, and who made a suicide attempt the day before I saw them, I must use the same code and be reimbursed in the same amount as the patient I saw earlier in the day who is doing very well. I only see them once every 6 months, and all they need is their Prozac prescription refilled. What a clever way to be able to get around the intent of 2902. In essence, they have...
Which code was it that you said was taken off?
Well, you guys will have to help me remember. There are actually a number of codes, but 99214 and 99215. And that's a fee schedule that I received this week.
That's for an established patient.
Pardon me?
They just failed to put those on.
I know. I think it was a mistake on their part, really. I think, you know, to give them the benefit of the doubt. And by the way, my daughter, who does all of my billing and scheduling and so forth, called this company, and they haven't called her back yet. And other of my colleagues have called, and they said, oh, we're checking into it. When a second, another insurance company sent their new fee schedule at the first of the year, I compared it with the 2013 schedules for both nurse practitioners and physicians. I noticed that when I used one of the two main codes that I use for most of my patient visits, the insurance company will actually pay me $25 less for that service than what the psychiatrist received last year. So what this means is that either they have decreased the rates to the psychiatrists, or they are not paying us the same as what they pay psychiatrists for the same code, both of which are in violation of 2902. A third insurance company, which is the largest in our area, and 50% of my caseload is insured with them, they also drop some of the commonly used codes that most of the other insurance companies pay for. For example, on Tuesday, I saw two new patients for the first time. When I see a new patient, I provide the identical 1.5 to 2 hour face-to-face extensive evaluation that I do for everyone, regardless of what their insurance is. Both of those patients required identical paperwork, report writing, ordering diagnostic tests, coordinating treatment with their therapists and with their primary care practitioners and with the medical specialist. With one company, with this largest company that over 50% of my caseload, I will be paid $111.87 less than I will with the other insurance company, because they simply don't have that code, and they require us instead to use a code that pays far less and which in no way accurately reflects what it is that I do. Again, as someone who kind of likes statistics, I am very concerned about what this is going to show down the road, especially when we're trying to achieve parity as far as behavioral health and medical, other kinds, types of medical treatment. It looks like our people aren't that serious, aren't that complicated. So, and with this particular insurance company, many providers in our area have resigned from that panel within the last 2 years, and they have transferred their patients to the rest of us who are still panel providers. My waiting period for a new patient is usually several months out. Of these two people that I saw on Tuesday, they called in November. And I was able to get them in this week. So insurance providers have found other creative ways to circumvent the intent of 2902. Two of my colleagues work in buildings where there are also psychiatrists and therapists and other psychiatric nurse practitioners. Within the past couple weeks, they have noticed that they are not receiving the same reimbursement as are some of us that are in our own office that does not have a psychiatrist. They have been told when they've checked with the insurance companies that because they are a part of a quote-unquote clinic, they are not obligated to pay at the parity rate. In fact, they rent space in that building and they share billing and secretarial services. They are not supervised by anyone. They are not employed by anyone other than themselves. And this insurance company has told them that they won't pay, and they consulted their attorneys before issuing this. So the status of access to outpatient psychiatric care for the commercially insured in Marion County. There are 11 psychiatrists in Salem who are in private practice and who accept commercial insurance. I called all of them yesterday. One is moving out of the area and trying to find other providers to treat her patients and, as you can imagine, is not having much success. Three have no room for patients until at least the next 3 to 6 months. Five are not accepting new patients at all. That leaves two psychiatrists who are accepting new patients, and unfortunately both of them have resigned from the panel of the company that insures all the state workers, 50% of my caseload. One of the psychiatrists who resigned from that panel told me that he filed 5 complaints last year with the Oregon State Insurance Division, only to discover that they apparently have no jurisdiction over this particular insurer. He, as well as psychiatrists and staff at other offices, also expressed concern about how misleading this insurance company's website is for patients looking for a provider. At first glance, and they have a lovely website, at first glance it appears that they have a large number of impaneled providers. But when the patients start to call, they find that at least half of the psychiatrists listed on that page only treat inpatients. And most of the others are either not accepting new patients, which is not reflected on the website, or they have actually resigned from the panel and have made multiple attempts to get taken off the website and have not been. The psychiatrist told me of a recent call he received from an insured individual who was sobbing, and I get these calls every week as well, as do all of my colleagues. They had been unable to find a provider on their own, so they sought help from the insurance company. The company found a provider for this individual. Their appointment is in 3 months in Southern Oregon.
You can't.
Yeah. It might even be in Bend. Wouldn't that be a surprise? My colleagues and I receive calls such as this sometimes several times a week. Psychiatric mental health nurse practitioners are overloaded, and we are in short supply as well. There are about 17 psychiatric nurse practitioners in private practice in the Salem area, all working in outpatient settings. There are many, many more who work in corrections, the state hospital, county mental health, and so forth. Of those in private practice, most of us have waiting periods of 1 to 4 months. Of the 17 nurse practitioners, only 5 are still on that panel I was referring to because they've resigned in frustration. At least 2 of those 5 are not accepting new patients. It's my understanding that at least 2 of that 5 intend to resign from the panel in the next few months. That will leave 3. Leaving hundreds more patients without a psychiatric provider. Commercial insurance in general, as I said earlier, is still not reimbursing behavioral health at the same level as primary care or specialty care. When I go see my adult nurse practitioner for my regular annual exam, and I have no health problems to speak of other than orneriness, but she receives double what I receive when I see a patient who is extremely complicated and who maybe just got out of the psych unit and who made a suicide attempt the day before they came in to see me. I'm almost finished. I think the other things that I have, I've already addressed. So if anyone has any questions or wants to tell me about something that I forgot to talk about. Madeline.
Okay. Thank you, Linda.
You're welcome. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm Madeline Simmons. I'm a psychiatric nurse practitioner in Bend. I have a full-time practice of adolescents and adults, and I've run my own business for 7 years. I have a bachelor's in nursing. I have 2 graduate degrees in psych nursing and bring 27 years of experience to my current practice. I also taught nursing at the University of Washington and Central Oregon Community College. I'm here to testify about the significant psychiatric needs of the populations in Central Oregon and the shortage of providers we are currently experiencing. Robin is right on with her very passionate plea. You might have thought she had too much coffee this morning. We have a disaster in Central Oregon, and it's really a mess, so I'm glad to hear how strongly that's being presented here. I'll start by sharing my experiences in Bend and Redmond. I have an office in Redmond as well, since I last testified before the House and Senate Health Services Committee last spring. One of the 7 nurse practitioners who sees kids in Central Oregon left. Those of us in our consultation group divided up our clients. She could not sell her practice because none of us wanted to pay for more work. In the fall, I began getting a large number of phone calls from significantly mentally ill clients in crisis. Retrieving my messages was like working the crisis line. And as I soon discovered, both the psychiatrists who served the OHP population at the main hospital had quit. So they were the only 2 working in behavioral health at the hospital, leaving only the county and a couple outlying clinics to provide for the OHP population. Many clients had a therapist in outpatient behavioral health, but no prescriber. So after a few days, I kept on hearing from clients, I was told that you could help me. And then I remembered an innocuous phone call I'd gotten saying, just wanted to make sure you'd be willing to still be on a referral list for the hospital. I thought, oh my gosh, I have just ended up on the list for a referral list for 2 full caseloads of psychiatrists who had moved from working at the main behavioral health hospital to private practice. My inquiries about when they would get a new psychiatrist, one was a child psychiatrist, one was an adult psychiatrist, were it'll be at least a year, Madeline. And so it's amazing to have...
But we are recruiting for 6. Exactly. And I have to be honest with you and tell you, we've interviewed 15 psychiatrists.
Okay, well, nobody's called me and said that they were coming yet. So during my 7 years in practice in Bend, 2 child psychiatrists have left the area. And both times they sat down with me, they had a stack of charts, we met in their office, and they actually went over the kids that they wanted me to take over for them. So there was a kind of nice warm handoff, we went back and forth, they had releases signed, and I picked up those kids from 2 different psychiatrists. At a recent OPA, the Oregon Psychiatric Association conference that Dr. Conant-Norville put together so well, one of the speakers said that there are 4,000 psychiatric prescriber openings or psychiatrist openings in the country, and there are only 1,000 people coming out of medical school focusing in psychiatry. So there are 3,000 openings that aren't being filled. And we live in Bend, Oregon. It's pretty gorgeous there. And if we're short on people, then I can't even imagine what it's like in other parts of the country. I've currently closed my practice to new clients for the first time in 7 years because I just can't take any more people. I mean, I get these sobbing phone calls. I got a phone call yesterday from a woman saying, I'm in crisis and my psychiatrist only has 12 minutes for me today. I don't think that's enough. So it's pretty intense. As a psych nurse practitioner specializing in adolescents, I again see many of the same clients that psychiatrists see. I do medication management and therapy, so I rarely do just meds unless somebody's already seeing a therapist. So I have the privilege of doing a half-hour appointment or a full-hour appointment, and I don't have employees, so I do all my own paperwork, but I am able to see people for a more extended period of time. I am now really kind of swamped with kids. So the kids who left these practices, many of them have OHP. I'm not a current OHP provider. I was when the contract went to the hospital. A lot of us weren't. You know, they didn't continue having us on the OHP panel. So now, when those two psychiatrists left, I'm providing gratis work and taking care of clients until I can get back on the OHP panel. Psychiatric care relies on personal connections, and fit is really important. I often see clients who've seen one of the male psychiatrists in town and then the other male psychiatrist in town before settling in my practice. One example is a 14-year-old young man who was suicidal, has been suicidal for a fair amount of the last 3 years. So since he was 11, he spent a fair amount of time with one psychiatrist and had really horrible medication reactions, got genetic testing with the next child psychiatrist that was actually really helpful and provided some insight into how the medications could be managed. They came to me, and I'm taking the information from both those providers and continuing care with this family. So I deserve equal pay for equal work when I'm dealing with this really complicated kid. The reimbursement equity that started in January has actually been really helpful for me. I got cut by 25% in 2009 and hadn't been willing to take on so many more people. Right now I've been taking a new client every day that I've worked since January in an effort to make the Affordable Care Act work. I mean, I want this to happen, and so I've been trying to do my part. But I can only do so much as a single person. The new billing codes likewise make it so that we can differentiate between an easy kid with ADHD who's doing great in college to this 14-year-old man who's acutely suicidal and has really funky genetics. So nurse practitioners tend to be strong case managers and collaborate with other providers. So I regularly call the therapist and say, hey, saw this kid, just want to let you know, this is the medication change I made. Call me if you have any concerns or feedback. So I do a lot of coordinated care. And one of the benefits of being in my own practice is I can do that. And it makes it feel like I'm doing a good job. One of the interesting things that we're doing to address the shortage and to address the healthcare reform is Bend started the first, or providers in Bend started the first independent practice association. So nurse practitioners, psychologists, clinical social workers, and I guess marriage and family therapists, so licensed providers, got together, started a mental health IPA where we're looking at how we can use the same electronic health record, how we can better collaborate care, and what treatment paradigms can we come up with to reduce the cost and provide skilled care. So as nurse practitioners, we're taking the lead in our community to be leaders and see how we can perhaps do better care. There is indeed a shortage of mental health providers, and I appreciate those of you who are honoring the fact that nurse practitioners are seeing really complicated clients. Again, any efforts you can do to recruit people to our area would be completely helpful. I'm happy to take questions. If anybody has any questions?
And the concept of the Independent Practice Association, this is Janine Smith, Senator, on the phone. Would you be interested, as we think about alternative payment mechanisms, are there models? I know there are for, primary care and other, but where you could be, Robin could capitate your group for a population and you guys, rather than this individual negotiation.
We're exploring that. So as a group, we're going to the insurance companies and saying, this is who we are. There are 47 of us. We're all licensed. We've been working in the community for decades. And we'd like to talk to you about providing services in a different way. People don't really know what to do with us yet because we are the first mental health IPA in the country. I think there have been a lot of there are a lot of medical IPAs, but we're the first mental health IPA, so there's a lot of education that's been going on with the different insurers. So there's certainly possibilities of providing for a group of people.
and we're exploring that.
I might mention that here in Salem, we formed the first psychiatric nurse practitioner IPA in the country a while back. Later this month, we're going to be meeting with the provider representative from the largest insurance company in our area to see if we can get a little bit of relief from some of these things. And then early next month, we will also be meeting with representatives from Oregon Health Plan to see if there is something that can be done about this. Unfortunately, as I say, it comes, and in their case, it doesn't necessarily come down to payment. It comes down to paperwork and requirements, not by Oregon Health Plan, but by the agencies who are contracted with them. And if there was a way to bypass some of this, you can bet most of us would be signing up to see Oregon Health Plan patients.
And that's where our IPA is really looking
right.
at. How do we specifically address the paperwork issues? And is the common charting that we're using that works for Medicare, is that a possibility to use for, like, serving Oregon Health Plan clients? So we're pushing and exploring possibilities to simplify and make care more efficient. Go ahead.
Pursuant to your question, Dr. Smith and Senator Miles Anderson and Senator Knope, this is Robin Henderson again. In Central Oregon, I'll tell you a little bit about the alternative payment methodology contract we just negotiated, because I think it's probably unique to the CCOs at this point. But it does remain on the physical side of the health plan only, because we're in a bifurcated system still, even though we have CCOs and theoretically we blend dollars. Yeah, just forget that at the door. In the new contract that the hospital and the IPA, and I'm speaking of Central Oregon IPA, which is the Physical Health Plan Provider Association, there is a global risk contract for all physical health conditions within the hospital, which is about 51% of the business, that underlies this. So the hospital went at global risk for everything on the physical health side of the plan, whether it's in our hospital or not. So the transfers that may go to Portland, we're on the hook to pay for. The St. Charles has a medical group that has approximately 9,000 covered lives. They went at risk for those 9,000 covered lives in their patient-centered medical home. And these are integrated medical homes that have will soon have psychiatry within the primary care home, currently have psychology within the primary care home, also have community health workers and community health workers and nurse care coordinators, RN care coordinators. We went at risk for those 9,000 covered lives. So between the medical group and the hospital, we're at 25% risk for the what is now 40,000 lives. The IPA has the same contract that our medical group has. So the IPA's contract mirrors our contract, and they're at 12.5% risk, and we're at 12.5% risk for their 30,000 lives. So it's a total global risk contract. Unfortunately, mental health was not included in that contract, not because the hospital didn't want to go there, but because that is managed by the county mental health, and the tri-county area in our region has something they call WebCo, and WebCo manages that. What we did with WebCo, because we are the only acute mental health provider in the region, and we see like 94% of the acute mental health conditions, we carved in an acute mental health contract just for those patients, but they maintained control of the outpatient and subacute residential business at this time so that that still runs through community mental health. And I think that provides a complicated picture of how this is working from a global standpoint. I've had several conversations at the CCO level to say, let's take a look at outcomes here, pursuant to mental health. One of the knocks that we get frequently is that outpatient providers who are not community mental health see people too frequently. And what I've gone back and said is, I'd like you to take a look at our outcomes from outpatient mental health and see, because we see them at a higher frequency, do our people go inpatient less?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really the question at the end of the day. We have to get to a global payment for mental health. But in order to do so, we need to come to the realization that community mental health doesn't own the acute care system. And so until we bridge that gap so the two can seamlessly coordinate dollars, which means getting over decades of infrastructure and bureaucracy, I'm not sure how we're going to get there. Long-winded answer to a short.
And as an independent outpatient provider, I'm not part of either of those systems, but I am the one seeing the kids
exactly.
in crisis
right.
and trying
exactly.
to get them to Portland.
So, any other questions for either of them?
I wanted to just very briefly, I forgot to, I'm not sure if this was passed out to you at all, but this was the thing that I forgot to talk about. A while back, I did, because I'm interested in statistics, so a while back I did basically took every single new patient who walked through the door in a 12-week period of time and just ran some statistics on their basically acuity. And so just there are just a few things here I want to point out, and I think this might give you a more accurate picture of who it is that we're seeing in private practice. Number seven, those who had a history of prior psychiatric hospitalization was 33% of the people who came in during that time. Two or more had, 56% had already had, at the time they walked in the door, two or more Axis I diagnoses. And what that means, Axis I is some sort of major mental illness. So these were already some pretty complicated patients. And then number nine, 72% of these people had already been diagnosed with a major mental illness before they even came to see me. Number 14, 78% were already taking two or more psychotropic medications. Number 16, 61% had a history of five or more psychotropic medications or med trials. 19, 39% had been severely enough ill that they had been able to attend work or school within the past year. 39%, number 20, also had a history of drug, alcohol, gambling, abuse, or dependence. And then finally, number 22, a whopping 72% had a biological family history of major mental illness, which tells us how strongly genetic and physiological these illnesses are. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions before we continue? This is the part where we would have public comment. No one has signed it. I don't want people to think that, well, you know, she didn't read the agenda. But as long as... All right. So we have about 10 minutes left. I think the thing on the agenda left, and there's probably not enough time to do that, is the task force recommendation principles discussion. What do you think, Dr. Kincaid?
Yeah, I think we're a little bit limited time-wise. I think there were a couple elements that came out that particularly Dr. Kluckman talked about having a more explicit complexity element in at least in the fee-for-service system. So that would be something we'll have to talk about at some point, and that's really not in one of our principles. Again, reflecting the comments of everyone around the level of complexity of both physical, social, and other aspects of patient care. So, you know, we do account for complexity of the visit interaction, but not necessarily the complexity of the patient in total during the visit. Now, in capitated systems or in systems where it really look at risk management and definitely have a risk scoring system. So, but again, that's more not necessarily related to directly to the fee-for-service payment. So, again, I think that would be more things to talk about there. I don't know, Dr. Kluckman, you have more comments?
Yeah, it's basically that, you know, the current coding system, the fee-for-service system, isn't set up to do that, and that's pretty vital for this. And, you know, we do see a lot of variation in the patterns of coding. So we're in, and the E&M coding system is new to mental health providers. And as you can imagine, when something's new like that and they haven't been used to it, the understanding of it and, you know, whether the presenting problem warrants that is also highly variable. I think this type of information that Linda Morley provided is just the kind of information that is needed to create the transparency necessary to see, you know, what are these patient panels like? And then the question also needs to be brought to bear is that in these patients who are on multiple medications with multiple problems, who aren't doing well, is there a role for a more collaborative model to probably improve, possibly improve their outcomes? And I know that when Dr. Conan Orville goes to Pendleton, he will see folks, you know, in that supervisory role with nurse practitioners, that some need some guidance and some don't. And so I think that that's the attractiveness to the collaborative model for patients who are really kind of struggling. You know, that's some of the concern I have. If somebody's been on, you know, three or four medications, five medication trials, they're still not doing very well, is this it for them? Or is there something else that can be done? And is there a way to bring together a highly skilled team? You know, I don't, you know, that could actually ensure that these complicated patients are getting the care that they need, because we have to deal with the variation.
All right. Any other comments or questions?
I have some. This is Lori Monis Anderson.
Okay.
I really thought that everyone actually was right on task, but my concern is that we really cannot, in the short amount of time, and what the intent of 2902 was, is to focus in on the way insurers are manipulating the system for billing right now. When I hear everyone talking about the coordinated care model, which I think is an excellent model in a lot of situations, especially with our CCO, when I hear about all the paperwork that is in would be in conjunction with the CCO model and OHP getting involved, that is a different issue, as well as scope and as well as the need for more practitioners, psychiatrists in particular, but all practitioners in the mental health field. That we cannot address either. To me, I thought that if we could narrow the focus into what we have right now, because this other issue that, and a lot of good information came out, that is really over and beyond, I feel, what this task force was organized to do. So that this just my perception as a legislator. Right now, I know that there are practitioners out there that are very frustrated with the system, and some are leaving the system and not coming in. So if we could somehow, and I'm not the guru on this, focus in on the insurers and coding and you know, things that we can put in statute that would give direction to the insurers as to what they could or could not do with manipulating coding and how they're paying people, providers in the mental health field. Again, this is my perception on the bill, and it's my perception after hearing all that good information. This good information today brings up a whole lot of issues that I don't feel that we as a task force could possibly solve. Thanks.
Thanks.
Can I make a couple comments? This is John Prastis from Regents. I think it's important that we hear a lot of anecdotal comments about causes and effects, and I think as we get to the point where we want to start making decisions, we really got to get back to fact-based, objective review of items. I kind of speak from an interesting angle. I came from Phoenix. I'm going on my one-year anniversary here in Oregon, and there's the market rate for commercial carriers in this market compared to the Southwest is materially higher. Relative to San Francisco, there's pockets where it's substantially higher. So I just, in reviewing what is an appropriate reimbursement and how you evolve reimbursement, I think it's really important to kind of look at regional, national benchmarks, really where things fit, because I do believe at the end of the day, the recruiting of physicians to a market is going to be a competitive advantage for the states and regions that can bring doctors and healthcare to that to their to the communities. And I just don't want it to always come back that reimbursement is the driver of recruitment activities, because our reimbursement is not that bad in this marketplace. There's other factors, and I think if we're not focused on all of the variables that are causing these issues, then we're kind of selling ourselves short as far as actually solving the problems.
I think I'd just kind of like to second that. I think it's important, as you pointed out, I mean, insurance premiums in Oregon in the commercially insured market are about average for the country, but our utilization is close to the bottom, and you know, so we have excellent utilization, and as many know, in Medicare, that results in a lower total cost of care. But in the commercial marketplace, it actually doesn't result in a lower total cost of care. And I think that it's fair to say that there are some areas where we are where services are under reimbursed, and that there are other market forces in other areas where there's tremendous consolidation that results in much higher fees, as John has pointed out. And one of the things that we want to be sure is that we do things in a way that's thoughtful, so that patients can benefit from the efficiencies. So if someone with less training can provide those services, the patient should get some cost benefit somewhere. Because if we keep just doing things that rise the total cost of care, then it's patients are already going to get squeezed out of the market with higher deductibles and higher co-insurance. Because the fact is, and I think John can say that as well, in the commercial marketplace, the insurance company margins are really quite low, and medical loss ratio for most of the major carriers are in the upper 80s, well above the national mandate of 85% for a large group. And we want to be thoughtful about how we can provide the most efficient, best care for people at a cost that they can afford. And I think that you're right, Senator Mona Sanderson, if there's manipulation and wholesale exclusion of codes that are not appropriate, that needs to be addressed and stopped. I know that there's some confusion out there about what actually is done and how it's done, and that needs to be transparent and clarified. If there are errors that are made, they need to be fixed. They need to be fixed fast.
All right. Thank you very much for your comments. Anything else? Meeting's adjourned.